Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. David Marinus is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and biographer. He's written books about Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Vince Lombardi, and others. David last visited Traverse City in 2016 when he came to talk about his book, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. His latest book delves into the personal history of his family. A Good American Family tells the story of David's father, Elliot Marinus, who was accused of being a communist informant during the McCarthy-era Red Scare of the 1950s. David talks this hour with author and commentator John Bacon. John asked David if writing a book about his own family was different than writing his other books.
In my other biographies, I started, even though they were well-known people, I started with treating them as strangers. I really didn't know the real story. And by the time I was done after 4 years, I basically knew more about them and their families than they did. Mm-hmm. And just to give you an example, so Barack Obama, when I was doing that biography, he would say that his Indonesian stepfather died fighting heroically against the Dutch in the fight for independence in Indonesia.
And it turns out.
And it turns out that he died falling off the ottoman, changing the drapes in his living room. But, so people would say, well, why would Obama make up this story? And I'd say, he didn't make it up. It's the story that his family told him. We all know the stories passed along, the mythology passed along from our parents and grandparents. So that got me thinking, do I know the story of my own family? And the shadow of my family's story was that my father, Elliot Marinus, who I knew as a wonderful newspaper man who taught me to never fall for any rigid ideology and search for the truth, when he was a younger man, was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, fired from his job at the Detroit Times that very day that he was subpoenaed, and blacklisted for 5 years for his earlier membership in the Communist Party USA. He didn't talk about it. I knew that, you know, as I was approaching 70 years old, it was a book that I had to write. And I knew that it would be psychologically difficult, and there were certainly times in the reporting when I'd say, come on, Dad, what were you thinking? As he was trying to defend something that I found indefensible. But I did try to use the same methodology that I use in all of my books, and to the extent that that's humanly possible, I did. As it turns out, through all of the difficulties that our family went through and through all of the somewhat psychological trauma that I went through trying to understand that period and my parents, it ends up as a love story. So that made it, in the end, that much more rewarding to go through that difficult process.
And I should say, it ends up as a very well-earned, hard-earned love story. All the facts are there. He hides from nothing. And therefore, the gratitude you feel at the end is sincere and heartfelt. So a few points leading up to this. One is Vince Lombardi, the book you wrote When Prize Still Mattered, a huge blockbuster bestseller. The first book of yours I read, I went back and read the others, of course, on Clinton and so on. But in there, you've got a brief little line that stayed with me all these years. And it was, like my father, Vince Lombardi got his break late in life. Mm-hmm. And I knew what that meant in the case of Lombardi. I didn't realize until I read the book how old he was, and he became the coach, finally, the head coach of the Green Bay Packers.
46.
That's right, which is old for that game, of course, especially after all those years with the Giants and whatnot, New York Giants, football Giants. But I had no idea what that meant in terms of your father. And of course, this story answers that question in considerable depth. And I've got to also say, too, when David, unbeknownst to him, has become a role model and a mentor to me and a tremendous supporter, and I've been very grateful for his help. But a few years ago, one of our various coffee clutches, we were talking about how we handle difficult subjects in our books. And he said, and I have not forgotten this, you can always be sympathetic, and you always must find the humanity in all your characters. And that is great advice, and not all journalists follow this. But in this case, of course, it was rewarded richly with your father.
Well, I found that doing that actually makes it easier for you to tell the truth. Hmm. And people don't want to read about saints, because no one's a saint. But we all
hate those guys.
But you have to give people their humanity. And that makes their flaws more understandable, more richer, and they're good. They're better qualities balanced out with that. So that's just my sensibility, to give people their humanity, to be sympathetic, to be skeptical but not cynical.
Skeptical but not cynical, not a bad way to start. With that in mind, with that background, let's dive in here. Of course, the book is about mainly his father, Elliot Marinus, born in 1918, the son of Jewish immigrants who grew up in Brooklyn, New York, an avid Boy Scout and a hardcore baseball fan and player. It turns out, by the way, Elliot's great-grandson, Charlie Marinus, is a hell of a ball player. He's 6.
According to his grandfather, he's a hell of a ball player.
It's a solid scouting report, I think. So, but he starts out with a rather conventional second-generation immigrant upbringing, but he goes to Abraham Lincoln High School on Coney Island, also the alma mater of Arthur Miller, well-known, of course, to literary types, and a very influential principal named Gabriel Mason. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, you have to understand that my father went to high school at Abraham Lincoln High during the depths of the Great Depression, and that was a deep influence on the students of that era. And the principal, Gabriel Mason, was a Spinoza scholar. Many of the teachers at Abraham Lincoln High School were Jewish scholars who could not get jobs in colleges because of the quota system and discrimination. Mason would walk around the halls of Abraham Lincoln High with a copy of Emerson's Essays in his back pocket. And he and many of the teachers would say to these students in 1933-34, you can't be the lost generation, the previous 1920s generation. The world is in too much trouble. And they inculcated in my dad and all of the students at Abraham Lincoln High in that era that they had to be activists, they had to care about the world, and they had to go out and try to improve it. And that's what led my father to where he ended up.
Pretty noble start, obviously. When he gets to the University of Michigan, which accepted Jewish students before the Ivy Leagues did, in great numbers, of course, Arthur Miller being one of them, naturally. He was a big man on campus right away. He was part of all the main honorary societies, including Michigamma, which is well known to Michigan alums. His nickname was Ace Marinus. He was cool. But clearly the thing that stamped him the most at Michigan was his time as an editor of the Michigan Daily, that is the student newspaper in Ann Arbor, for which Arthur Miller also wrote. I never wrote there myself, despite being a Michigan alum, but I was on the board there for 3 years and got to know the place a lot better than many of the graduates, including Eugene Robinson, your good friend and fellow Pulitzer Prize winner. And in our business, they say the newspaper is a daily miracle, and it kind of is, that it comes out every day, pretty much no matter what, or it used to. But the Michigan Daily is a bigger miracle because they've got no faculty support, no funding, you don't get any grades for this, you don't get any money for this. It's student-run entirely. 21-year-olds working on no sleep, directing 19-year-olds, what could possibly go wrong? But when I talked to the Pulitzer Prize winner, Anne-Marie Lipinski, friend of yours also, mm-hmm. Eugene Robinson, others.
Robin Wright,
of course, of The New Yorker, a good mutual friend there as well. When I talked to these people about their time at 420 Maynard Street, you can tell right away they had to swap 5 years, the New York Times, the New Yorker, for one more year at 420 Maynard. This place stamps you like few others, and it might have been at its peak in the 1930s when your dad was on the staff there.
You know, it's hard for me to compare it with other college newspapers of that era, but I've certainly read college newspapers of the modern era. And I have to tell you, the Michigan Daily in 1936 to 39 was incredibly sophisticated. They had brilliant book reviewers, movie reviewers. You know, they'd write series about the Tennessee Valley Authority. They covered international politics better than most daily newspapers around the country. It was quite a place. And yeah, the staff included not just Arthur Miller, but Stan Swinton, who wanted to become the vice president of the Associated Press. and another guy became the editor of Scientific American, all in the same class. John Ciardi, the poet. I mean, it was a very rich intellectual environment into which my father, was a deep part of that. And I think that his love of newspapers actually began a little before that. He was one of the editors of the Lincoln Log, the high school paper. But it was really at Michigan, and that influence that lasted his lifetime.
Luckily for you, researching your father after he passed away, obviously, he left 150 columns and stories for you to trace down, thanks to the new archives and so on, and the Bentley Historical Library. And that gave you a pretty good record of his thinking at that time, and also his writing style as well, which is quite strong.
Yeah, I was very lucky. You know, when I was starting the book, I have an older brother and sister who were probably more affected by my father's blacklisting than I was, because I was only two when it happened in 1952. And Jim, my older brother, was six, and Jeannie, my sister, was five. And they actually spent one semester at three different schools because of it. But when I was starting to do the book, my brother raised some very serious questions, challenging me, saying, well, what can you really know about what Dad was thinking? That's a very good question. And, of course, you never know what's going on inside the brain of someone else. Everyone in this audience has had a million thoughts that you haven't even told your spouse. It's just human nature. So I'll never know that. But he did leave this written record, starting at the Michigan Daily. And luckily for me, John, as you know, right when I was doing the research, the Bentley Historical Library digitized the Michigan Daily. And Terry McDonald and the other people there gave me a head start getting, 6 months before they went public. So I could just type in the name Elliot Marinus or Arthur Miller or of my mother's older brother, Bob Cummins, who fought in the Spanish Civil War, another Michigan grad. And I came up with all of the stories about them. It would have taken me months to do it otherwise. But reading those 150 editorials and columns that my father wrote helped me get an understanding of his thinking during that time. And really throughout the rest of his career, I could trace the path of his thought through his writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, in those, they took on politics and the TVA, for crying out loud. It was a national student paper, which no student paper now aspires to, in fairness to them. But what came out of that also, of course, is his political views were very strong. And those are in there. This is the first seeds you see of his growing communism, if you will, which sounds obviously very radical to us today and still kind of is. But at the time in Ann Arbor, certainly, it was not that uncommon. Fielding Yost himself, the athletic director of the university at that time, would rail in letters that I've read about the radicals on campus and the communists and whatnot, who objected to the fact, of course, that he would not play an African-American player in a game against Georgia Tech. So this was part of the 1934 zeitgeist at that time, and Ace Marinus came by a few years later. At that time, though, to be a communist in Ann Arbor was not that uncommon, and they're basically fighting against three things, more or less. Go ahead.
Well, you see the motivation, the idealistic motivations, whether you also see the naivete about the Soviet Union. And the motivations were the Great Depression, the failures of capitalism during that period, a search for something better, the rise of fascism and Nazism in Europe, and racial segregation, which was prevalent then and has been throughout American history, unfortunately. So I think those were the three issues that drew my parents towards the Communist Party USA. It wasn't like a majority of the students were members of the Communist Party. But on the other hand, it was a little bit like the 1960s, where students were radicalized by the events of that era. Whether it was Vietnam and civil rights in the 60s, or the Great Depression and Nazism and fascism in the 30s. Similar motivations that can lead people to a place where they don't understand the totality of what they're supporting, but they do understand the idealistic motivations that brought them there.
In their defense, by the way, the internet was a lot slower in the 30s. You could only find so much. So, and George Will makes this point in his column about your book, a wonderful column, that it's reassuring to know, as tumultuous as our times are now, things were a lot more tumultuous, of course, in the 1930s America was all over the map, basically, at that point.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, as much as I, of course, any writer will accept a positive column or review, whether they completely agree with the conclusions or not, I don't agree with George Will on all of his politics. And I wish I were as optimistic as he was about the equilibrium that would follow. I'm a little less so at this point in looking at America today. But it was a tumultuous time then. My family was able to recover from it. Mm-hmm. A lot of families were destroyed. My family was just disrupted.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, David Marinus talks more about his latest book, A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to John Bacon's conversation with David Marinus.
On campus, he meets a young 17-year-old local lass named Mary Cummins. Tell us how they met and tell us about that story.
So I'm as Obama said, he's called himself a mutt like me because of his... So I'm a mutt of my own sort, a Jewish father from Brooklyn, New York, and a Methodist blonde mother from Ann Arbor, Michigan. She was a townie. And her older brother, Bob Cummins, was at the Michigan Daily in 1934 to 1937 with Arthur Miller, was one of those involved in supporting Willis Ward, the black football player who wasn't allowed to play against, was it Georgia Tech?
Georgia Tech.
And was an activist on campus. And Bob Cummins, my uncle, and two other Michigan students, the day after school ended in 1937, went to New York, took a boat across the Atlantic, a train across France, climbed over the Pyrenees Mountains to fight in the Spanish Civil War against Francisco Franco and Hitler and Mussolini. About 4,000 Americans and Canadians did that for purely ideological reasons. It wasn't even legal in the United States to fight as an American in that war, but they believed, they were later termed premature anti-fascists, but that's what they did. And two of those three Michigan students survived. One of them, Ralph Nefus, who happened to be Arthur Miller, the playwright's close friend at Michigan, mm-hmm. They washed dishes together at the Wolverine. Miller drove Ralph Nefus from Ann Arbor to New York before he went over to Spain. And in a haunting passage in his autobiography, Time Bends, Miller writes that the entire time they were driving, he'd look over at Ralph Nefus and think he was looking at a dead man. Well, it turned out he was. Nefus was captured by Franco's troops and held in a cathedral in the town of Alcanese, and then executed. And one of the most moving moments, one of my policies is go there wherever there is. So my wife and I traced my uncle's route in Spain for this book, and the other two Michigan students. We went to that cathedral in Alcanese. Late afternoon, there was a stork on the top of the cathedral, on the spire, sort of symbolic of what, life or death. This man came up the steps with a huge key and opened the door for us, and we walked in. And this was 1938 when Nefus was killed. And all of these years later, in 2017, it still felt like a dungeon of death inside. Mm. So Nefus was killed. Bob Cummins, my uncle, survived, as did the third Michigan student, Elman Service, who went on to become a great anthropologist. When My uncle in Elman Service went back to Michigan. The students held a huge welcome home dinner and rally at the Michigan.
With hundreds.
With hundreds of people. 600 people came, welcoming them home. One of those 600 people was the 17-year-old younger sister of Bob Cummins, Mary Cummins. Covering the event for the Michigan Daily was Elliot Marinus, and that's where my parents met.
And the rest. She was taken by your dad immediately, and we'll see photos later on. He's a dashing guy. He knew what he thought. He was on the Michigan Daily.
Well, it was more the other way around. She was beautiful and smart.
Doesn't hurt. By the way, you mentioned, of course, one of your rules is go there. Your four pillars, your four legs of your table, yes. And writing a book. Let us know those.
Well, yeah, my four legs of the table. The first one is go there, wherever there is. So I've said this many times, but I'll say it again for this audience. It meant when I wanted to do the biography of Vince Lombardi, turning to my wife, Linda, and uttering the immortal loving words, "How would you like to move to Green Bay for the winter?" Which we did.
By the way, you didn't answer the question, though.
For Christmas that year, she wore a cheese head and carried a sign that said, "Help."
Tell somebody about me.
Yeah. So I've made it up to her ever since. We've gone to Rome for my Rome book, and Puerto Rico many times for Clemente, and Vietnam for the Vietnam book, Kenya for Obama, and Hawaii. But go there is the first thing, to understand the cultural geography of whatever I'm writing about. Very important. The second leg is the archival documents. So for this book, Good American Family, I went to 14 archives around the United States and Spain, from the Bentley Historical Library to the Hatcher Library at Michigan, to the Detroit Library, the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State, the Tamamut Library at New York University, which has all the records of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The New York Public Library had the yearbooks and other materials for Abraham Lincoln High School,
Wow. Which
they brought out of some storage facility in New Jersey for my wife and I to go over, which was quite something. So that's the second leg, is the archival documents. The third leg is interviews. For this book, it was a little less so. For my Bill Clinton book, I interviewed 400 people, and I probably could have interviewed 10,000. He knows everybody. But in this case, this book takes place from 1930s to the 1950s, basically, and all the characters are gone. But I did do interviews with relatives and descendants. And the fourth leg, which is sort of metaphysical, is to search for what's not there. To break through the mythology of what's been repeated again and again about a story and try to find the real story.
Which brings us to, and a nice segue, World War II. Your dad signs up eagerly for this, and his role there, I think, is rather heroic.
My father enlisted right after Pearl Harbor. Because of his radical past, he was investigated by military intelligence when he applied to go to officer candidate school. There are several stories there that I don't have to tell tonight, but he got through that, became an officer, but the military at that period was treating leftists at a one remove. They tried to send them to isolated posts around the country for the first several years of the war. So my father found himself in Marfa, Texas, and Oklahoma. He wanted to get to Europe, but it didn't happen. Then in late 1944, he was made the commander of an all-black unit. Now, the military in World War II was racist. It was segregated. Black troops were segregated from white troops. And the officers for most of those black companies were white. They tended to be one of two types. Either Southerners, who were mostly racist, and the military figured, well, they deal with black people all the time.
How'd that work out?
Yeah. Or Northern radicals, who, unlike many officers, would actually want to be the, you know, work with black troops. Many officers thought it was a dead end for their careers. So my father was put in charge of a salvage and repair company. He organized it at Camp Lee in Virginia in late 1944. And during that period, he wrote home to my mother about 150 letters, which were, again, very crucial to my understanding of my father and to myself and my family in terms of race relations. Because my father was trying to organize a company and get young men to go fight in a war ostensibly for liberty and democracy for a nation that treated them as second-class citizens. You know, the contradiction and hypocrisy is right on the face there. And you see in the letters he wrote to my mother, his commitment to making those young men feel that they were getting a fair shake from him, that his NCOs, who were African-American, were not Uncle Toms, that they all felt that they were being treated fairly, and they had a spirit of corps in that group that he was incredibly proud of. And his motivations to make America live up to its ideals are as evident in that period as any time in his life. And reading those letters was a very powerful reminder to me. And most of my books, race runs right through them. Mm-hmm. You know, the American dilemma of race. My son is an author, and he's written books about, he wrote one about the first African-American athlete in the South, sort of the Jackie Robinson of the Southeast Conference. Now, what is it that draws my family to that issue, and you see it beginning with my father?
Very powerful stuff, very much ahead of his time in terms of the norms of that time. Good segue into the 7 years pass, of course, after World War II, and your father's journalism career continues in a good direction, does very good work, highly regarded at the Detroit Times, owned by the Hearst Corporation, still, of course, well-known. They own Cosmo and a bunch of others to this day. They're obviously on the conservative side of things, but he does fine work there, and they've got no problem with him. Clearly, however, he is summoned. And in late winter of 1952, his life changes dramatically, and so does yours, partly.
Let me tell a funny story first to lead up to that. My dad was a really great all-around newspaper guy. He could write brilliant headlines. When Bing Crosby died on a golf course, my father's headline was, "Bing goes at 74, two over par." Which was both literal in every possible sense, two over par in golf and two over the average age of a man in that era.
By the way, fellow newspaper guy, you can't coach that. You have half an hour to make a headline, and he pulled it off.
But at the Detroit Times, my dad was the great rewrite man. And it was a Hearst newspaper, and one of the big events of that era was the marriage of Rita Hayworth and the Aga Khan in Nice, France. And Luella Parsons was covering it for one gossip column and Hedda Hopper for the other. And the Hearst papers carried Luella Parsons. And she had the inside track on this marriage and was going to write the story about it because she was closer to Rita Hayworth than Hedda Hopper was. So the Hearst paper is waiting for her file to come in, and it's late. So the editor turns to Elliot and says, "Elliot, you're Luella Parsons." So he starts banging out this story, you know, and then right at deadline, the machine starts clanging, and Luella Parsons' real story starts coming in. This is the way my dad would tell the story for years thereafter, breaking out into laughter. And so the editor takes the copy that Luella filed and what my dad wrote, looks at them both. "Oh, hell, Elliot's is better. Let's go with his." This is old school front page stuff.
The man who was not there, of course.
But anyway, so he was really highly regarded at the Detroit Times. But in 1952, when the House Un-American Activities Committee came to Detroit, ostensibly, primarily to go after the United Auto Workers, Local 600, which was a leftist union with communist leadership, American communist and socialist leadership. My father was named, do you want me to go there?
Sure, let's go there.
By a woman who became known as the grandmother spy. Her name was Berenice Baldwin. She was recruited by the FBI in 1944 to join the Communist Party and infiltrate it. She rose up through the ranks to become the secretary of the Michigan Party, and she came in from the cold in 1952 to testify at these hearings, and she named hundreds of names over that course of that long period. One of those names was Elliot Marinus. When she testified on February 28, 1952, a HUAC investigator went to the Detroit Times building, went into the newsroom, issued a subpoena to my father, and he was summarily fired.
All in one day.
Yes. And I was not quite 3 years old, so I have no memory of this. But, of course, what transpired after that affected myself and my siblings and my parents for many years thereafter.
During that time, he refused to name others. He's given that option. And if he had, his life would have gone a lot easier, if not perhaps peacefully.
Well, the point of... See, the House Un-American Activities Committee already knew all this stuff. These were basically show trials because they already had all the names. They'd been, my father had been followed by the FBI for years and named by the grandmother spy for years in the FBI files. But what they wanted was to show the public this reality or their version of it and bring people in, force them to confess, to be contrite about their sins, and to name names, which my father refused to do. So he actually wrote a statement that he wanted to deliver to the committee about what he thought it meant to be an American or an un-American, being called that by a chairman of the committee, John Stevens Wood of Georgia, who was a segregationist, involved in a lot of nefarious activities, once belonging to the Klan, being the driver of a car that carried the lynched body of Leo Frank, a famous Jewish industrialist who was lynched in 1915 outside of Marietta, Georgia, falsely accused of murdering a 13-year-old woman in his pencil factory. This same John Stevens Wood, who drove the car that carried the lynched body of Leo Frank, was the chairman of the committee that called my father un-American. So my father wanted to write about what it means to be an American, which is as relevant today as it was then. And the committee would not let him deliver the statement unless he confessed and named names.
So that went unspoken. It was not part of the record. It was in an archive, of course, that you dug up years later. We'll get to that shortly. But let's talk some more about the people involved in the House Un-American Committee. It's quite a list of accusers, and in fact, if you want to pick some enemies, these are the right enemies to have.
You know, everybody knows about Joseph McCarthy, and sort of it's called the McCarthy era. McCarthy was a senator. He ran a subcommittee in the Senate that became famous in 1953-54 when his undoing in the Army-McCarthy hearings. But it was the House Un-American Activities Committee that did most of the damage. That went around the country, not just to Hollywood, which many people have heard about the Hollywood 10 and the investigations there, but they went to Detroit, to Cleveland, to Chicago, to all of the industrial cities of the Midwest and elsewhere, New York, and called in hundreds of people and destroyed their lives. People who were not Soviet agents. My father was not a Soviet agent. He might have been naive in his beliefs, but that's the extent of his wrongdoing. You know, you can disagree with it, but that's part of the American, ostensibly, the American democracy. But so that committee was comprised of largely, the chairman was generally a Southerner, generally a segregationist. John Stevens Wood, who I've mentioned, the chairman, the counsel for the committee, Frank Taverner, was a Virginia segregationist, part of the Byrd Machine, Segregation Now, Segregation Forever. One of the committee members was from Michigan, from this part of Michigan, Charles Potter. And I found him to be a very interesting figure in this book. Charles Potter fought in World War II, like my dad. He fought in Europe. He was heroic in World War II. He lost both legs fighting in the Colmar Pocket. He went through the Hürtgen Forest and into France and fought until he was wounded severely, came back to Michigan. Like many young veterans, got involved in politics, a Main Street Republican, elected to the House, put on the House Un-American Activities Committee, made his name at those hearings where my father was called before and fired. Actually, Charles Potter is responsible for the title of my book because he gave a speech shortly before that where he expressed shock that anyone from a good American family could be involved in radical politics, communist politics. I saw that speech and I thought, well, I came from a good American family. And that sort of was the tension of my book. Charles Potter, after those hearings, was elected to the Senate from Michigan. And then he was placed on the subcommittee with Joseph McCarthy. And he saw McCarthy's manipulation, the use of hysteria and fear for political purposes, and he came to regret it. And years later, he wrote a book called Days of Shame. Who's going to write that book 10 years from now? And will it take 10 years to write it?
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of John Bacon's conversation with David Marinus.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to John Bacon's conversation with David Marinus.
Of course, we're into the aftermath now. That happens suddenly. They've been lurking. I think 37 agents at some point had tracked him.
Yeah, I got it took me a year and 2 years to get my father's FBI files. They're pretty voluminous. 37 informants and agents were tracking him from 1946 to 1952. Recording every place he went, all the license plates of everybody who was at a meeting. It was both shocking and prosaic at the same time. You know, just these accounts of license plates and meetings. And then what were they doing? You know, but that's what was going on. And so I got all of those FBI files from the National Archives and the FBI after placing a Freedom of Information Act request. Took about 2 years to get them all.
But it worked.
And yes. And the reason I got them, you know, it can take even longer. But one of the archivists at the National Archives said, David, if you're named in any of those papers, FBI files, you can get them quicker. So there was one report where it listed the children of Elliot Marinus, including David Marinus, 1.5 years old. And that's why I got them quicker. So I'm in an FBI file.
What'd they find?
That I wet my bed? I don't know.
I guess they let that go then. Good for them. The aftermath, though, as you said earlier, you felt not too much. Of course, you're so young. But your older siblings, your brother and sister, certainly did feel that. And you said 3 schools in 1 year, for example. And your dad, the strength of your parents during this time impressed me greatly. To constantly be in fear of who's going to find out next. To constantly be in fear of you're doing good work, you got a good job. He's clearly a serious newspaper man. And knowing that any single day and any single job, it can all go poof tomorrow. And your parents stuck together. They didn't lose faith. Yep. It's pretty incredible.
It was 5 years. fired in 1952. First, we moved to Coney Island, where my father's parents lived in a small apartment. All of a sudden, here comes their son and little Shiksa wife and three kids, you know, in a two-bedroom apartment. My father worked for a newspaper there that folded a month after we got there. We moved back to Ann Arbor and lived with my mother's parents on Henry Street in Ann Arbor for a while. And then he got hired by the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And then the FBI came to Cleveland and said, you hired a former communist. He was fired from that job. We moved back to Detroit. And for about a year and a half, my father tried to sell party favors to labor unions, some kind of a picnic store, which is pathetic. If you know my dad, he couldn't sell anything. And then in 1956, there was a strike at the newspapers in the Quint cities of Iowa, Bettendorf, Davenport, Moline, East Moline, Rock Island. And my father was hired to be an editor of the strike paper. It was kind of a ragtag operation with a lot of, you know, ne'er-do-well people like my dad, or people who'd been hounded or troubled for various reasons, ended up with this little strike paper. Turned out to be a salvation in a way, because, again, my father was a great newspaper man, and he put out this really good-looking little paper called Labor's Daily. And it so happened that every couple of weeks, the paper would run a column called Hello, Wisconsin. And that column was written by the founder and publisher of the Madison Capital Times, an old progressive friend of Robert La Follette's named William T. Evue. And Evue saw this little paper that was publishing his column and turned to one of his editors and said, this thing is better than our paper. Who's running this? Elliot Marinus. It's the spring and summer of 1957. We've been bouncing around for 5 years, as you said, you know, from Ann Arbor to Cleveland to Detroit. My older siblings were in three schools in 1 year. Summer of 1957, Joseph McCarthy has just died. The Capital Times in Madison hires my father. The Milwaukee Braves, our new baseball team, is on the way to winning the World Series. We live near the Vilas Park Zoo in Madison. I was afraid I was going to be eaten by a lion. I was only seven. But
by the way, the Lions don't beat anybody.
Oh, he said it, not me.
Am I wrong, people? Am I wrong?
Unfortunately, neither did the Tigers this year. But in any case, our family was saved in 1957 after those 5 years of bouncing around.
This is some of the, it's not the most dramatic writing compared to the Committee of Course in World War II and the Spanish Civil War, but I have to tell you from an emotional point of view, you're on the train on this ride with this family, and the one that felt to me like the ultimate kick in the gut, you're kind of girding for the earlier hits. You kind of know this stuff is coming. It's getting dropped from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. You think, okay, you're out. You're in a major paper in a major city, and people forget how big Cleveland, you know, how powerful it used to be and how important that paper was. Okay, good. He's on his feet. He'll go from there. And then, again, in an instant, there it goes. That's the one that felt to me like the unexpected kick in the gut that really got to me. And I was not expecting anything good to happen in the Quad Cities. So at that point, I thought, okay, he's off in the wasteland. And that was his saving grace, amazingly.
Yes. And by the way, the FBI was still following all the way up to Madison. But from before the committee came in 52, every FBI report said we have no material connecting Elliot Marinus to the Communist Party anymore. But they still kept following him and firing him from that job in Cleveland, even though there was no evidence of him being involved at all.
Even from them.
From them, right. They had nothing. They did earlier, and again, I have to say that that's the part of the book that was the most difficult for me to write, to see my father, like in 1939, writing this very eloquent, incredibly indefensible essay defending the Nazi-Soviet pact. You know, there were things like that my dad was doing in that period, which I'm just shaking my head. And, you know, how much he knew about the murderous Stalin regime is an open question to me at some point. But it's clear that by 1952, he had seen that and moved away from the Communist Party. And yet it was for the next 5 years after that that our family suffered the most.
What also struck me is that your dad expressed no bitterness toward his accuser, of course, Bernice. And I don't know if I could have pulled that off.
Well, that's the part of my father that, well, I mean, I admire both of my parents, and that's why I say at the end it was a love story. You know, so many people who went through that experience were forever embittered by it or had this enormous ideological switch and became neoconservative, staunch anti-communists. My father went through it and was able to maintain his innate optimism and idealism. And that's what he inculcated in me and my siblings and everybody in our family. So that, and my mother kept the family together during those difficult 5 years. She had a policy, even though we had very little money, of trying to buy a house wherever we were so we'd feel some measure of stability, even when there was none other than that. And so their capacity to get through that as survivors with their optimism and idealism intact, but a more realistic perspective on the world, was hugely important. And, you know, my father went on to rise through the Capital Times to become its executive editor by the end. My mother went back to school and was Phi Beta Kappa at Wisconsin and became a book editor. My older siblings were both much smarter than me. One became a professor at Amherst, and my sister, a chief research librarian at Carnegie Mellon. And so and my little sister was a classical pianist. So it was.
So you're the screw up then.
I'm
your
totally the completely the screw up in this family, believe me. But that's a pretty good American family.
We're going to end this portion with the statement his father had written for that House Committee on Un-American Activities. And that same statement he was not allowed to give, of course, now finally comes to light in 2019, both in his book and here tonight. So without further ado.
You have to understand that this statement was buried until May of 2015 when I was at the National Archives and all of the HUAC records were opened. And there was a box just about the Detroit hearings, and there was a file that said Elliot Marinus. And when I opened that file, the first thing I found was this statement that I never thought I would find. And the most emotional part of it was that it was banged out on an old manual typewriter. And my dad, old school newspaper guy, was a terrible hunt and peck typist, and he was always pushing the wrong key and then Xing it out and typing over it. And the keys would stick. And so it starts statement of Elliot Marinus. And the S in statement went up a half space the way they would on those old typewriters. And it was literally at that moment when I saw that raised S that everything washed over me. That I, you know, here I was in my 60s and I'd never before that moment allowed myself to fully feel what it must have been like for my own dad at that moment when he was in the crucible. Statement of Elliot Marinus. I was taught as a child and in school that the highest responsibility of citizenship is to defend the principles of the U.S. Constitution and to do my part in securing for the American people the blessings of peace, economic well-being, and freedom. I have tried to do that to the very best of my ability. And for doing just that and nothing more, I have been summarily discharged from my job. I've been blacklisted in the newspaper business after 12 years in which my competence and objectivity have never once been questioned. I must sell my home, uproot my family, and upset the tranquility and security of my three small children in the happy formative years of their childhood. But I would rather have my children miss a meal or two now than have them grow up in the gruesome, fear-ridden future for America projected by members of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. I don't like to talk about these personal things, but my Americanism has been questioned. And to properly measure a man's Americanism, you must know the whole pattern of a life. I feel that nobody has the right to question my Americanism, least of all a committee which itself has been called subversive, un-American, and anti-labor. I view this committee's attempt to muzzle me and drive me off my job as a direct attack on freedom of the press and the right of newspaper men to participate freely in the political life of the country without fear of reprisal. The U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights are not simply musty documents in a library. They have meaning only if they are used. To betray and subvert the Bill of Rights is the most un-American act any man or committee can do, for that document was brought into being and maintained throughout our history by men who gave their lives and their blood. Every newspaper man knows that history is not a printed page. It's the passion and striving, the struggling and endurance of men and women. These qualities that went into the making of our nation can be discarded only at great peril to ourselves and our children. From the time of Peter Zenger, the colonial printer who defied the British Crown's effort to impose censorship in the American colonies, right down to the present, newspaper men have zealously defended freedom of the press. For the First Amendment is not only a guarantee of free speech and a free press, it's also an indispensable part of self-government. That's what makes this committee so dangerous. Ostensibly designed to protect the government against the overthrow by force and violence, it proceeds by force, terror, and threats to overthrow the rights of the American people. The committee reflects no credit on American institutions or ideas. Its attempt to enforce conformity of political or economic thought is a long step toward dictatorship that holds the greatest danger to the entire American people. In this country, we have never acquiesced in the proposition that people could be punished for their beliefs. Statement of Elliot Marinus, read by his son.
Gets me a little choked up too. That, folks, is what real courage looks like. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
That was David Marinus talking with John Bacon. David Marinus's latest book is A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.